Hello, everybody. Welcome to another edition of the Orthodox Nationalist. It is September 3rd. Well, when you're listening to this, it will be September 4th, 2019. As always, I want to thank my supporters. The crises that I face, this never seemed to end. But you guys have managed to keep me on the air for some time, and for that I'm humbled and I thank you very, very much. And what that means for me is that I end up working a lot harder, uncovering a lot of things in the Slavic past, things relevant, whether it be to Orthodoxy or nationalism or to agrarianism, that haven't been discussed in the past. So much of the greatest Russian and Belarusian writers have not been translated into English, and the result is you have a lot of ignorance. Alexander Dugin is a classic example. People pass judgment on a man who have written volumes and volumes of material, very little of it translated into English. And Johnson's Law kicks in. They say stupid things like he is an advisor to Putin, and that he's Putin's advisor, a foreign policy advisor. And, Dugin has no connection with Putin. There's no position that he has within the government. He does not advise the president on any level whatsoever. But Americans don't know that. Dugin is someone who they don't understand. Even, educated philosophers in this country have no idea what he really means, even if they do read the language. And as always, they react with hostility. And that's what happens with so much of this stuff. People who have no idea what they're talking about mouth off and disparage entire peoples, entire schools of thought, or people. And one thing I want to do here is to end that and eliminate that. And because of you guys, those of you who've supported me financially, I'm able to do that. I'm able to engage in translations and research that I never would have otherwise. Now, I've said this before, I'm going to say it again. I was told in grad school that unless you are in a university or a think tank, or maybe government, you can't live the academic life. I mean, they said it in those terms. It's simply not feasible. But you guys have permitted me to prove them wrong, that I can lead the academic life and do exactly what an academic does on a daily basis, while having complete freedom and having no connection to any university or think tank or God knows government or even church for that matter. I am part of the Russian Orthodox Synod of Damaskin in Moscow, but this is certainly no official publication or there's no connection between the two things. But and I'm not supported by them financially in any way. So I am completely independent, which means I'm completely free, and that's because of you. So I ask you to continue to support me, and I truly appreciate it. And one of the things that this allows me to do is deal with people who are obscure but shouldn't be obscure. Geniuses who, the Russian literature and translation has really only been in the last 50 years. Prior to World War II, there was almost nothing in English from the great Russian writers, except maybe for Pushkin. If you wanted to learn Russian, you had to go to Harvard. I think Columbia, that was about it. There was no other place to learn Russian in America. it was the end of World War II that forced the Americans to learn a bit more about the country. Everything we know about Russia comes from the last 50 years, 60 years. And it's highly incomplete. It's ideologically biased. They still haven't, you know, gotten over the fact that Woodrow Wilson isn't president anymore. And the kind of the white government of Kerensky still is there, or the Menshevik government is their main focal point. But, you know, romanticizing Bolshevism, so long as it's not Stalin, is a daily occurrence in academia anyway. But one of the themes on this show, the 10 years of its existence, has been agrarianism. The idea that modernity is really to be found in the city, like the Italian city republics, you know, Florence and Siena and Venice and Genoa. Prior to that, you have the city-state of Tyre and then Carthage. The city always represents this Gnostic desire to dominate the countryside and the people in it. The victory of Rome over Carthage was a victory of the land power over the sea power, of warrior aristocracy over the merchant, and over usury. And I want to talk about two people, Jakub Kolas and Janka Kupala, the two national poets of Belarus, who, though they have checkered pasts, are some of the most interesting agrarian theorists out there. Janka Kupala is considered the greatest Belarusian writer of the 20th century. Their connection with the Soviet Union is very, very mixed and checkered, even bizarre, but they wouldn't leave their country. But I want to preface all of this, and I may have mentioned this before, but I want to do a little bit more detail now. A short story, well, not short story, it's like, you know, 30 pages, 40 pages. Anton Chekhov's The Black Monk. This is his critique of Friedrich Nietzsche. And it's almost completely unread. And it serves as the backdrop for a lot of the anti-Gnostic stuff that we do here. Now, I've been studying Nietzsche since I was 18. And I've taken, you know, some positive things. I've taken a lot of negative things. You may not like him, but you have to respect him. But he's not someone to be dismissed. The Black Monk is based around an anti-hero, so to speak. Andrei Kovrin. And he is a psychologist, or a philosopher, especially in psychology. And he's in a state of overwork and burnout in Petersburg. And as a result, as typical, you see this in a lot of Russian stories, he's ordered to take rest in the countryside, you know, at someone's estate. You see this over and over and over again in Russian literature. Remember, Chekhov was an MD, a practicing doctor, on again, off again. So, you know, his scientific knowledge was pretty substantial. So Kovrin takes refuge at the house of his friend Igor Pesotki. So someone from the city, someone who really only knows the city, someone suffering from the maladies of the city, has to go to recover in the countryside. In other words, the city is this pathogen that you can only handle for so long. You need to cure the countryside for a while, and only then can you go back. Now, when Kovrin gets there, he is overwhelmed by the vegetation, by the production of fruits and vegetables there. He's never been happier. In fact, his happiness is suspicious. It sounds very much like the manic phase of bipolarity. In fact, it's almost a textbook example of it. And he meets a woman there, a very attractive, very very vulnerable, Tanya. And it's often the case in Russian literature that these women connected to the land are in fact Russia herself. And she's simple, but not a simpleton. She says, and I quote, "I never even dream of anything but apples and pears. Of course, it's very nice and useful, but sometimes one longs for something else, for variety." So the civil virtues aren't really enough, at least on the surface, for her. Everyone in the countryside sees the city both, you know, negatively, in the sense that this is the oppressor, and positively in that there's a lot going on there, a lot more than here. The simple virtues sound great when you're living in the city, but they're boredom when you're in the country. But he develops what can only be called really the perfect life. Because you know, he has this new wife, you know, apparently in Russia you just get married when you talk to someone in these novels. You know, no problem there. And, you know, he's working there and this be, they're close friends and it's almost a utopian commune after a short time. But there's a legend. Igor tells him about a legend and let me describe it the way and how Chekhov describes it a little bizarre. Igor tells the anti-hero this. 1,000 years ago, a monk dressed in black wandered throughout the desert, somewhere in Syria or Arabia. Some miles from where he was, some fishermen saw another black monk who was moving slowly over the surface of the lake. This second monk was a mirage. Now forget all the laws of optics, which the legend doesn't seem to recognize, and listen to the rest. From that mirage, there was cast another mirage, and from that a third, so that all the images of the black monk began to be repeated one after another, from one layer of the atmosphere to another. That he was seen at one time in Africa, another in Spain, another in Italy, then in the far north. Then he passed out of the atmosphere of the earth and now is wandering all over the universe, still never coming into conditions which he might disappear. Who knows, he could be on Mars or some star of the Southern Cross. But the real point, which the whole legend hangs, lies in the fact that exactly 1,000 years from the day that this monk walked in the desert, the mirage will return to the atmosphere of the earth again and will appear to men. And it seems that 1,000 years is almost up. According to the legend, we may look out for the black monk today or tomorrow. And that's a bizarre description. The image is, in fact, an image of an image. It's a picture of a picture. It's a manipulation of light. Now, of course, he's going to meet this monk, and unlike the legend that's been explained to him, he is spoken to. Chances are it's entirely in his head. He's the upswing of a manic episode isn't really known for hallucinations, especially not this coherent. But this monk, in the way he this image, in the way he speaks to Kovrin, is very much the way that the Antichrist is depicted in Vladimir Solovyov's Brief Tale of Antichrist, that God has chosen this group of people on earth to move evolution forward, to create a new order based on knowledge held by an oligarchy of science, and it'll solve all the problems of this temporal life. The Antichrist mentality is based on that. So you have two things happening. You have the city and the countryside. You have a man who has a lot of mental problems, no fault of his own, but who is in love with the countryside. But, of course, that's not going to be enough for him for long. He does meet the monk, and the strange thing is that he meets him with very little fanfare. You know, he shows up, and it's like he sees him every day. And here's what he says to him. This is what the monk says to Kovrin. "Yes, you are one of those few, justly called the chosen of God. You do the service of eternal truth. Your thoughts, your designs, the marvelous studies you're engaged in all your life bear the divine, the heavenly stamp, seeing that they are consecrated to the rational and the beautiful, that is, to what's eternal. Yes, of course, the grand, brilliant future is in store for you. And the more there are like you on earth, the sooner will this future be realized. Without you, who serve the higher principle and live in full understanding and freedom, mankind would be of little account. Developing in a natural way, it would have to wait a long time for the end of its earthly history. You will lead it some thousands of years earlier into the kingdom of truth, and therein lies your supreme service. You are the incarnation of the blessing of God which rests upon men. As of all life, the purpose is enjoyment. True enjoyment lies in knowledge, and eternal life provides innumerable and inexhaustible sources of knowledge. In that sense, it has been said, in my Father's house, there are many mansions. Now, anyone who reads Nietzsche or even Francis Bacon, this is something, or Solovyov for that matter, this is not anything new. It's a common trope. But Kovrin says to this image, he says, you know, I'm really not in my right mind. The reason I'm here is because I'm exhausted and burnt out. And we're pretty much sure he's bipolar in the broad sense of the term. And he speaks to this phantom and asks, can I trust that this is real? Which is an odd thing to ask. And the monk says to him, and are you sure that the men of genius, whom all men trust, didn't see phantoms too? The learned say, now the genius is allied to madness. My friend, healthy and normal people are only the common herd. Reflections upon the neurasthenia at the age, nervous exhaustion, and degeneracy, etc., can only seriously agitate those who place the object of life in the present, that is, the common herd. Exaltation, enthusiasm, ecstasy, all that distinguishes prophets, poets, martyrs for the idea, from the common folk, is repellent to the animal side of man, that is, his physical health. I repeat, if you want to be healthy and normal, go to the common herd. Now, that statement is true as far as it goes. But I'm not sure it's true in the sense that you're listening to a phantom telling you what your destiny is. Those are two completely different things. So Kovrin becomes convinced by this apparition that he is a scientific genius, that the herd, the world, doesn't understand him, can't understand him, or people like him. So his mental illness isn't really a mental illness. And he admits it throughout. This is nothing, you know, he knows that he's off balance. But that's not a bad thing. It's not an illness, really. It's just a product of not being a part of the herd. The outer coating of a life of greatness and service to humanity is really what it comes down to. And that's really what it is. Now, after this meeting, and this back and forth, he was at the height of his mania, and he went back into the house, just lighthearted, and ecstasy, really. Chekhov describes it, the little the monk had said to him had flattered not his vanity, but his whole soul, his whole being, to be one of the chosen, to serve eternal truth, to stand in the ranks of those who could make mankind worthy of the kingdom of God some thousands of years sooner, that is, free men from some thousands of years of unnecessary struggle, sin, and suffering, to sacrifice to the idea everything, youth, strength, health, to be ready to die for the common weal. What an exalted, what a happy group. He recalled his past. He recalled his hard work and what he had learned and what he had taught others. And he began to believe that the monk is right. I am extraordinary. But Kovrin marries this very pious and frail girl, Tanya. She is representative of old Russia. It's extremely common that Russia is represented by a young girl, usually ending up spurned. And the symbolism is clear. There's almost no major Russian writer of the era that doesn't do this. You have a man from the city, you know, representing all the errors of Petersburg and the urban life in general, European urban life in general, and a simple woman who is intelligent, pious, focused, but maybe a little boring. the same demonic drive that makes him think that he's above the common herd is going to be a bit of a problem when he realizes that Tanya is part of the common herd. She marries Kovrin because she is convinced that he's destined for greatness. He's going to be something extraordinary. And though it's left unsaid, he kind of makes up for what's lacking in her mundane life. Her mundane life isn't so bad. She doesn't know what she's in for. But then, worrying about this farmstead that he's recuperating in, his host, Igor, says, "But I'll tell you, my dear fellow, the worst enemy in the garden is not a hare, not a wolf, not the frost, but the foreigner. What I fear most is that my daughter will marry some fine gentleman, and he'll be greedy, and he'll let the garden to people who will run it for profit, and everything will go to the devil in the very first year. And our work females are the scourge of God." And what he means there is a woman's hypergamous instinct, which of course is only a limited factor in a society like the Russian, will cause her to marry someone, you know, who has money and who has ambition, and then will come and buy the place and run it like a big machine. That's what he thinks, and that's what he fears. Kovrin becomes really possessed by this apparition. But Tanya is described as feeling like this is the early part of their marriage. She's described this way. "At one minute, such joy would swoop down upon her that she longed to fly away to the clouds and pray to God. At another moment, she would remember that in August she would have to be part from her home and her father. And goodness knows why, the idea would occur to her that she was worthless, insignificant, and unworthy of a great man like Kovrin. And she would go to her room, lock herself in, and cry bitterly for hours. When there were visitors, she would suddenly fancy that Kovrin looked extraordinarily handsome, and that all the women were in love with him and envying her, and her soul was filled with pride and rapture, as though she had vanquished the whole world. But he had only to smile politely to the young lady for her to be trembling with jealousy, to retreat to her room, and tears again. These new sensations mastered her completely. She helped her father mechanically, without noticing peaches, caterpillars, laborers, or how rapidly time was passing." This is what happens when something good is immersed in something evil. This is the entire plot of The Idiot from Dostoevsky. What do you get when something pure is placed into an evil world? This is the incarnation of Christ in his life. It's the same thing. This without sin in his case, but in this case, she doesn't have the experience. She doesn't have the background. She knows she's marrying a Petersburg guy. There's women everywhere. Morality has completely collapsed in that part of the country. So on the one hand, she thinks that she's extraordinary for conquering a guy like this. On the other hand, she realizes what kind of a guy that is and what that might mean. You see, the ideology that Kovrin has internalized raises him above all conventional and natural laws. You see this in Dostoevsky's Crime and Punishment. And in his mind, of course, he owes the simpleton nothing. She is as worthless as the Russian peasant community she represents. The Russian peasant community isn't worth anything with these people. They're oxen. The foreign forces that will take over this orchard and turn it into a machine are the exact same forces that now manipulate Kovrin. And of course, Tanya knows this, doesn't really know how to articulate it yet, doesn't want to articulate it yet, and this is how she suffers. Well, finally, she sees her husband speaking with this apparition. Of course, there's no one there. So he's speaking to an empty chair. If you've seen A Beautiful Mind, one of my favorite movies, dealing with schizophrenia, you know, you've seen this phenomenon. She's very worried about him, needless to say, and she tries to interrupt their communication. But all the apparition never seems to say to Kovrin is that this overflowing joy is a normal state of man, or at least people like him. Eventually, he has to go back to the countryside. And Chekhov says that he's drinking a great deal of milk, which is an odd thing to point out. But the symbolism of milk is overwhelmingly powerful. It's a symbol for the mother. It's a symbol for old Russia. It's a symbol for the maternal. It's a symbol for health. Milk is connected with breastfeeding. This incredible drink that babies rejuvenates their whole immune system. It's extraordinary. And Tanya says, you continue to drink this. It does you much good. Well, she's talking about a lot more than milk. Milk is that nurturing of the countryside, the Russian earth, the Russian nation, of course. And he's slowly cured of this. His mental illness starts to go away. Again, in A Beautiful Mind, he does take his medication, which back then, for schizophrenia and bipolar, was stuff like Thorazine and Haldol, which puts you out. Now today it's different, but he couldn't think on that stuff, so he didn't take it. Well, the same thing's happening here. The milk that he's receiving, so to speak, is curing him. The lifestyle that he's leading outside of St. Petersburg, he's getting better, because this is everything. This is a city. This is the artificial, the fakery of St. Petersburg. He's going to church services. He's following the calendar. Chekhov mentions that we're in the Dormition fast at this particular period of time. But he doesn't want to be cured. He finally figures out that a mental illness, at least in this case, isn't a mental illness. Here's what he screams to her. I went out of my mind. I had megalomania. But at least I was cheerful, confident, even happy. I was interesting and original. Now I'm more sensible and solid. But I'm like everyone else. I am a mediocrity. I'm weary of this. How cruelly you've treated me. I saw hallucinations. But what harm did they do? What harm did they do to anybody? So he's aware that he's hallucinating. And he doesn't care. And dripping with sarcasm, he says this to her. How fortunate Buddha, Muhammad, Shakespeare were that their kind relations and doctors didn't cure them of their ecstasy and their inspiration. If Muhammad had taken bromide for his nerves, worked only 2 hours out of the 24, had drunk milk, that remarkable man would have left no more trace after him than his dog. Doctors and kind relations will succeed in stupefying mankind, in making mediocrity pass for genius, and in bringing civilization to ruin. Oh, if you only knew how grateful I was to you. The whole point is that mental illness is what the inferior call the ability of the superior. They don't understand it, so they're scared of it, and they label it. It's a non-medical statement that they make. He certainly believes that Tanya is her inferior, and of course, old Russia and the agrarian life by extension. And he drives her to despair on purpose. He tortures her. He cheats on her. He takes up with an older woman. And it doesn't say so, but they're quietly divorced. Again, in Petersburg at the time, this was able to be done. But her father was absolutely racked in pain and worry over the suffering of his daughter. And the orchard falls into disrepair. In a letter, Tanya writes to him, he says, I took you for an extraordinary man, a genius. I loved you, but you've turned out to be a madman. That's how she concluded a letter. By the way, if I had a nickel. Igor, who at one time had been so charitable to him, dies from stress and worry. But the guilt got to him. He is not a sociopath. He does have a conscience. A sociopath has no conscience. But a narcissist, someone with bipolar, it may be buried, but it's present. One of the things that makes a narcissist's life so difficult is that he does have a conscience. And he surrounds himself with people that convince him that he doesn't have a problem. He destroyed an entire family, developing a hemorrhage in his throat, which is, we get no more information about that. He dies in a pool of blood. And just before he dies, the apparition tells him that his death is necessary because even his body can't stand being controlled by a spirit of such genius. In other words, the spirit, the genius that he has, overwhelms his bodily organs, and so he has to die. And it's a shame that Chekhov remains pretty much unread by all but specialists in the field. But what's significant here is this short book sums up the criticisms of modernity. You know, things I've made, so many others have made over the decades. Chekhov is not known as a social critic or philosopher. He's too practical for that. But it's just not true here. One of my favorite works of Russian literature of all time is Warden Number 6, which is Chekhov's greatest work. Black Monk, The Shooting Party, so many other things, shows Chekhov, despite the fact that he's an MD, has an anti-modernist view of the world, or at least an anti-urban view of the world. Black Monk is about man demanding the elimination of all boundaries for the sake of ego and power. Only a constantly renewed and reinforced world of illusion can maintain it. And it's interesting to note that Chekhov says that even the very beginning, that the arts of horticulture, the communication that peasants have with animals, and remember, a lot of city people thought that peasants can actually speak to animals and speak to the earth. And to them, it was probably true. These ancient ways, are gone now. And they really could have this intuitive communication. We don't even know about this anymore. Now, of course, the orchard has been bought up and either bulldozed or is being formed like a machine. So I like The Black Monk because it really is the background and the preface to the anti-modernist and anti-urban mentality that's so common. You see it in Russia. But the two things about Belarus and Ukraine is that their cities were dominated by foreigners. Jews, Germans, Russians, overwhelmingly. Natives were in the countryside. So the city to them was evil for a whole bunch of reasons, not the least of which is that it was foreign. Jakub Kolas, who died in 1956. Again, one of the great agrarian poets of the Belarusian nation. He does make his peace with the USSR. But he sees, at the same time, he sees the world dominated by evildoers. He was a member of the party, but I don't think he was a very good member of the party. He sees a world that's recreated in images and pictures that the dominant classes create for the sake of reinventing reality for the rest of us. This is a Gnostic cult in Eric Vogelin's sense. It images a world that really doesn't exist, but one that they want to exist. It doesn't recognize the world's order and structure. It seeks to impose its own. Image is a means of doing this. It's a sort of a fantasy that we place between us and reality. But art and literature to Kolas are weapons. This is a prophetic mission. His big concern was to give to the downtrodden, the villagers and farmers, weapons to use against their social betters. And he didn't care who they were. Belarus, during his lifetime, was ruled by Poles, Jews, Soviets, Russians, Germans. At one time or another. And it was extremely confusing. The period of time between 1917, 1920 was, one power after another dominated this area. And that meant the ruling classes were from different ethnic groups. So what it came down to was the Belarusian farmer against the world. He thought that the Soviet Union was going to do that, and the way that they propagandized Belarusian as opposed to Russian farmers, he thought that was going to be the case. The notion of industrial progress has nothing to do with happiness. People aren't happier now than they were in Roman times. I guarantee you it's quite the opposite. Progress and development only makes sense if you're talking about moral and emotional happiness. We're talking about happiness as a healthy contentment. Not the kind of happiness, this overwhelming mania that Kovrin had, but this healthy contentment, I don't know how else to put it, which is about the last thing that modern people have. The good exists on earth. It's the peasantry. They're the stewards of the earth. This is biblical in significance. Their lives are simple in the best sense, like Tanya. They're not simpletons by any means. They're based on the simple wisdom and virtues of farm life. Progress means absolutely nothing unless it can be proven to improve the care and produce of the land. Farmers care about their land above all else, and their family and community are the extension of this land in existence. It's organic in the actual literal sense. But war has shaken this simplicity. Tolstoy's War and Peace, we have the exact same problem. War, especially modern war, slaughters peasants. It slaughters peasants by the millions. Modern total war makes the slaughters of the Khans or Napoleon pretty minor. Don't forget, that too is also part of technical progress. And its contrast with simple agrarian life couldn't be more striking. Nature, for the modern man, is purely quantitative. Nature, for these guys, is qualitative. It's the beauty, the regularity, the law-bound nature of the land that makes it almost venerable. He has a realist metaphysics. The logos manifests in matter, granting it its law-bound nature. I mean, evolutionary theory can't make any sense out of natural laws, because either A, they pre-exist in matter, which they can't handle, or B, equally inadmissible, that the laws of nature evolved at the same time as nature as a whole. Neither one makes any sense. To claim that the laws of nature on which evolution depends themselves evolved is absurd, both logically and scientifically, yet they remain. So what's the connection between matter and the laws of matter? Nature is an object experience as a whole. In Heidegger's language, it's a creation of a home. Nature suggests a love of place, the landscape, the rivers, the mountains. This is as much part of the person as anything else. The slopes in the land, the idiosyncratic shapes of the parcels, roads, the topography. It's ethnic, and the people living in this topography come to develop an identity partially based on the physical features of the landscape. Both of these guys are ethnic nationalists. Both writers support this as a social idea, and it's a holistic and organic approach to social life because it takes everything within itself. The agrarian life is inherently ethnic because the community needs to be tightly integrated to assist one another within harvest time, crises. But that's an agrarian tradition from Ottawa to Peking. This kind of solidarity implies an ethnic, linguistic, and moral agreement, a firm agreement underlying it all. But this sort of agreement is, you know, foreign to the universities and foreign to Soviet commissars. It was the farmers and the workers who built the nation. And yet it's the politician, the general, the stock speculator that produce nothing, that control everything. That's the very nature of injustice. The abstraction from power, from the producers to the parasites. It's the height in satanic inversion. And when I say worker, in this particular case, I'm not just referring to people who use their hands, I'm intellectual workers. Inventors and scholars and everything else. They're employees too. They don't control anything. But agrarianism has always stressed the return of power to the producers, especially the rural communities from which all wealth derives. So what do they have to do? The regime, I don't care whether it's Soviet or Western, they have to humiliate someone before they oppress them. So the farmer has to be called a hick or a yokel or a redneck. The dehumanizing label of white trash, then they can justify the oppression and destruction of an entire lifestyle. They could pump drugs into the area and then complain that they're all on drugs. Only when the city dwellers view themselves as sophisticated and they contrast their own lives with the ignorant hicks, then can they justify forcing farmers to produce cheap food and later to fill the ranks of the factories in the cities. Urban civilization is inherently parasitic. It's a strain on the natural landscape, and it takes far more than it gives. The city is a mechanism for total universal labor control. That's where the cities come from. Now, the farmer adds to nature's power to produce his product. The factory has to force its product into a specific mold, determined by engineers. This distinction, both moral and economic, couldn't be more substantial. That's the difference between modern and medieval, between rural and urban. The village is inherently socialist in the best non-materialistic sense of the term. It's a community based on significant elements of commonality. The peasant lives his life in union with logos, since his livelihood depends on the cooperation of natural law with his required work. This means, of course, that God works through natural law, that, by the way, he's uncreated energies, to bring about the products universally required for human life. Law is God's presence. The law-bound nature of matter is what makes farming possible, actually what makes anything possible. As I've said, those laws have to be eternal. Therefore, evolution can't be true. Now, it is curious that Kolas joined the Bolshevik Party. His social views, his religion, seem to be the total opposite of the Bolshevik movement. But he wasn't trusted. In his Easter Eve, one of his more religiously oriented poems, he speaks of the agrarian life as continually manifesting the resurrection. Christ's resurrection, in other words, obviated the constant circle of life so loved by the pagans. Christ offered a man a way out for the Nietzschean eternal return. It's powerful stance that goes like this. Of sound from the pine wood musician, it stood in silence, meditating. It seemed for Easter quietly waiting, all terrors have quite disappeared now. Custis has whispered in his ear now. From joyful thought of the great feast day, the beasts feel it, the birds feel Easter. The fir trees feel it, the spruce wood, the evil folk have all turned to good too. All things with God's blessed feast are breathing. No robber will now dare deceiving, to crouch with drawn blade by the roadway. For now the mighty and the lowly keep Easter's holy celebration, and their hearts feel jubilation. And that is not my translation, by the way. But that could have been written by Isaac of Syria. It's a rejection of, well, the constant eternal return of Nietzsche was the former state of the earth. Everything lived in constant repetition and cycle, season upon season, finally ending in death. Christ changed this. Before the Paschal day, the earth was gray. It seemed to have no specific purpose outside itself. But like all agrarians, Kolas saw that man's sin affects nature. Before Pascha, nature is dark and somber. Christ is laying in the grave. Flesh, the natural order, appears dead, but of course isn't. But it's also clear that the Paschal feast is something of immense social value. People come together and cooperate in ways not normally seen. See, the agrarian life, it centers around social cooperation. No agrarian society can survive without it. So Pascha is an extreme manifestation of the natural social requirement. It's the foundational ontological reality that makes sense out of the necessity for cooperation, for even mundane tasks. No crime can be committed because there are too many people. But it's not just a random collection of people. It's a Christian people united in language, faith, tradition. That collective unit, in solidarity, is capable of any feat of strength. This is what survives plagues, wars, colonialism, genocide, for centuries without breaking. And this is what the city people call backward and superstitious. He defines the church as a supernatural repository of all human and natural potential. Ludwig Feuerbach held that the sacraments, he was Marx's teacher, that he held that the sacraments were different aspects of man's striving, the projections of our frailty. He was one of the great atheists of the 19th century and Karl Marx's most important influences. But Feuerbach, I don't think, realized how correct he was. This is the case. But it's not all those things are. The idea of a sacramental system as a concept of striving is not absurd from a theological point of view. Claiming that this striving exhausts all it is, that's not true. But for Kolas, this naive pop psychological view isn't rejected. The central issue is that the church is truly holy because it contains Christ, who is the full manifestation of what both man and nature are called to be, And it can't be without his presence. Without his presence, it would just be a cycle without end. But the grace that purified human nature through Hades, Hades really also, remember, is a poetic simile of nature as she lies in wintertime. Being an atheist, materialist, and agrarian is a contradiction. The laws of nature, which have to be eternal, so clearly manifest in the agrarian life, speak to the existence of God. It has to. It speaks to his care for humanity and the necessity of cooperation with the divine presence in nature. It's all present in the agrarian life. The farmer's cooperation with natural law to produce his crop is the origin and the practical connector of Chalcedon. The cooperation of the human and divine natures in God. The laws of nature must have existed prior to the creation of matter, which is very difficult to argue with. But remember, warfare, fear, change everything. Kolas becomes a supporter of the Soviet Union, and I don't know how sincere this is. You know, concepts like Marxism, Leninism, Socialism, Bolshevism, they were always confused. Very few were able to separate them. But he believed in 1917 that because of the overthrow of the monarchy, that a new era of independence could begin. This is what the Bolsheviks promised non-Russian republics. By the 30s, Kolas had been was suddenly extolling the building of socialism, not just in Belarus, but elsewhere. All of a sudden, he's concerned with industry. He becomes concerned with the motion and seemingly random internal process of change. It's very strange. But there is a nominalism. There is a superficial nominalism of Marxism, and he rejects it. He says, they are born, end in sunset and light and night, changing the courses of rivers and tides. I have no prophetic voice. Each creature is marked, each to its own life, endless motion, eternal youth. That's my loose translation of his work. But the point is clear. He has no control over the eternity of cause and effect. There must be something else, that which corresponds to our immaterial consciousness and freedom. So much of what he does is, in the Soviet era, seems to reject the Soviet mind. The New World, which is written in 1923, attempt to understand the mentality of the peasant and his use of the land to overcome alienation. But the narrative is significant only that it embodies his vision of the law that governs social life. Now, Soviet hacks, you know, hail this poem as a justification for its steel shafts and everything else, but it only goes to prove that the Soviet mind has become atrophied. Ideological uniformity by force destroy the mind. There's no real justification to place either of these writers within the Soviet camp. They did what they did to survive. The USSR was quintessentially anti-poetic and nominalist to an extreme. But both of these writers are nationalists and agrarians. They were icons of anti-Soviet thought despite everything. Kolas saw the USSR as a colossus that sought not just to remake reality, but to define it. But Kolas saw the specifically modern disease of alienation to be overcome only in the nation. Within the Soviet Union, he thought maybe an independent Belarus could be renewed. He was naive. But the nation in his mind, and all, you know, the definition of the narod is a community of language in the broadest sense of the word, the structure of communication. Tales from Life, which he finished in 1921. There's a swamp, the dead matter, upon which Peter the Great erected his Gnostic demonic city on the bones of the Orthodox Cossacks, symbolized by the old ruling class of the Petrian Empire. Now, in Belarus, the Petrograd state was largely invisible. The ruling class was instead a small army of Polish Catholic landlords and Jews, the omnipresent Judaic Kahal. But the swamp means far more than his Soviet interpreters understood. To refer to Western Russia as a part of the Muscovite inheritance is simply not true. this was a, you know, a foreign, you know, very orthodox, but non-Russian part of the empire that was pretty much at war with it most of the time. But an aristocrat's carriage gets caught in the mud and the rescue effort fails entirely. When this carriage, the aristocrats are in, it's stuck in the swamp. They're now at the mercy of the peasants who have to rescue them. They have no idea how to deal with this crisis. They just expect peasants to assist because this is what the Petrian order does. We're aristocrats. You have to take care of us. The swamps that Petrograd is built upon have now swallowed it. By the way, the carriage has all the treasure of the manor in it. So the ending is that the carriage gets deeper and deeper into the morass and darkness falls. Part of the problem, of course, is the ethnic issue. This is not a traditional Muscovite culture. This is a westernized, semi-Polish, semi-German, semi-Russian upper class. This is Petrograd, not Moscow. No identity, no sense of purpose. Tales from Life is about his view of the Tsarist state. When I say Tsarist, I'm talking about the emperor. I'm talking about Petersburg as it relates to the non-Russian republics. The carriage with the treasures of the manor falls into this swamp, and the aristocrats have no idea what to do. They're disconnected from the land. They're disconnected from any really mechanical ability. It just sinks. And they look and they just expect the local peasants. Their names were Basil, Cyril, Anton, Ignat, and Gabriel, to rescue them. What do these people owe these, you know, secular Masonic aristocrats? Well, because of the nature of the order that's been placed upon them, there really is no cooperation among these guys, and it sinks into the mud. And it shows the power that the peasantry has. He's talking about the nature of the future. A Lonely Tree is a poem about survival in the post-revolutionary world. It's an anti-revolutionary poem. In times of crisis, what remains unchanged? What is the spiritual core of a people? That core is what we preserve as writers. Lay deep roots in the earth, and that can weather the storm. Again, the Crossroads Trilogy brings to mind the classic meeting place of spiritual and material worlds. Like The Lonely Tree, it's again another ethno-nationalist work, showing how national patriotism is absolutely essential for socialism to develop. And this, of course, was his concern, which eventually, you know, had the Soviets distrust him. Class is never enough, not because it's such a slippery term, but it's only a negation. It's just a demand to become what others are, to control one's own life. But to control one's own life, well, even Rockefellers don't control their own life. We're all at the mercy of something else. But remember, Belarus, under Nicholas I, you know, power was wielded by the Jewish landlord, the occasional Pole, occasional German. Writing in the USSR, Kolas is careful to avoid mentioning Jews, but no one knowledgeable about the area can ever mistake his constant reference to magicians and sorcerers. He's referring specifically to the Kabbalah in that case, but he can't come out and say it. So here's a guy who spends his entire career as a Soviet citizen, accepting the Soviet life, but writing poetry in such a way that it came under the radar of the censors. Part of the reason he can get away with it is that he was non-Russian. The Soviets were very worried about revolution coming from the non-Russian republics. Yanka Kupala is now he was the anti-Bolshevik. Kupala never joined the party. These guys don't differ in any way. One of his central themes is history is little but treason. Civilization is always imposing its distorted, perverted, and violent will on culture. Culture is something agrarian. It implies something organic. While civilization develops in cities and urban elites and oligarchy are the beneficiaries. Now, a healthy urban culture is possible, but as soon as it removes itself from natural bonds, it becomes civilization. In Oswald Spengler's estimation, it's imperial by definition. The land, too. There's a social metaphysics here that the idea of substance from, you know, Plato onward derives from the idea of a plot of land. The substance is the land as a whole. Accidents are what derives from it. Without the land, there are no crops, no life worth living. Land is substance, both Aristotle's or Spinoza's or even Plato's definition. It grows crops, it buries my ancestors, it is who I am writ large. I'll be buried within it. It's greater than all of us. Both of these guys define injustice as living off the labor of others, to be a parasite. It doesn't even have to be economic, it could also be emotional. Now, the small landowner is the opposite of a parasite. He's responsible for his own food, clothing, shelter. This landowner is part of a larger village. He can't be an exploiter. He may be exploited, but his general self-sufficiency creates a consciousness that is firm, traditional, and religious. He's hard to defeat. Only the banks and compound interests are able to defeat him. Labor is not accumulation in Locke's sense of the word. Labor and property are really one and the same concept. Just one is stationary, the other is dynamic. They require each other. The agrarian life is labor under natural law. Labor works on property, but property only has meaning with labor. It's one and the same. So this is a different concept of Marx's alienation. It refers to their separation. Once property and labor are separated, which, by the way, both socialism and capitalism demand, death is a result. In the Egyptian and Hebraic numbering system, the numbers 1 and 2 are very symbolic. In agrarian terms, the number 2 is the land. It's that which is passive. Number 1 is the unity, the patriarch, God, that which is active. If the two are separated, you get 3. Gimel, or the camel, it refers to the desert. If God and the land are separated, you get death. You get desert. The camel is needed only because the desert is created when labor is separated from property. 1 and 2, as numerals, are distinct, but not essentially distinct. These numbers are also male and female. The natural order is represented in them. Number 1 is male, number 2 is female. But in the ancient system of numerology, when the laws of God manifest in natural law, are separated from the land, from the mentality of the peasantry, you get a desert, which is found in number 3, or the camel. Camel is the only way to get through it. Evil is then dependence. So injustice is a system of economic organization that institutionalizes dependence. But dependence, of course, is the other side of the coin of parasitism. The state, capital, so they're all the same in this regard. Socialism and capitalism both require and depend on the state. Most of us know that the creation of the capitalist order in England required extreme amounts of violence to drive the peasant commune off the land. The so-called Glorious Revolution was based on this concept. So to hold that the free market is independent of the state, or even opposed to it, is a fantasy. Capitalism didn't develop in a vacuum. The so-called self-made men of capitalism were made because the old economic order was in ruins as the state forcibly removed communes off the land. And the same concept in Progress. 1915, Kupala says, "Progress is just a better way to slaughter one another." Science can't hide from the responsibility for World War I and everything else afterwards. In ancient systems, the government fell apart to make way for oligarchy. Communal tradition made way for a technocratic society where all culture, so to speak, is dictated by the mass production line. The state and its capitalist masters ruled through images. That's the ontological opposite of the icon. It represented man as the Enlightenment saw him, a mere bundle of nerve endings without any inherent purpose waiting to be manipulated. I had a whole show on Adam Kadmon, what Antichrist really was, this image, that new man, that all these ideological systems wanted to create. The final theme of Kupala is nature. Nature with him modernity, regime in the most general term. There's two very general ontologies, man and nature. The latter is dead in John Locke's sense of the word, no intrinsic purpose, and man is merely matter in motion. Both are overseen by the regime, which of course is this amalgam of private and public capital wielded together into an oligarchic whole by media, images, and universities. Of course, the truth is different. There's no essential separation of man from nature. Man's a part of it. His reason, to the extent that it serves to do something more than just justify past behavior, is above nature only in the sense that it can abstract from it and come to rational conclusions and events. It exists to see logos. It exists to see the laws present in matter. It exists to deduce from the ordered structure of the cosmos that it is no accident. Natural law doesn't just serve the earth, but the entire cosmic universe. Logos alone holds it together as the object, for lack of a better phrase, the unified field theory. Christ's logos is the unified field. If nature is our mother, in the symbolic sense, then the empire is our stepmother. The stepmother is an artificial imposition on the family. The stepmother proverbially exists only to, because the father is seen fit to bring her home. She has no relation to anybody. The stepmother is a cause of tremendous violence, even today. She's a cause because she's forced to care for children who do nothing but remind her of the woman she replaced. The sexes aren't artificial creations, of course. They're natural outgrowths of substance, the land. Isolating a human person from the land leads to the absurd theories that women and men, or women are men, only better. You know, feminism, this nonsense comes from this separation of man from the land and man from natural law. In the village, men and women were equal in most socially significant areas. Their equality was proportionate, however, not quantitative. The one thing that Kupala never wavered from was Belarusian independence. He resisted the Soviet Union, but because Lenin kept Belarusian as a local language, it made it easier for a lot of these guys to accept it. He even was convinced for a while that maybe the Soviet Union could provide the structure for a strong, independent Belarus. He's very naive, of course. But it didn't take long before Kupala was purged. He wrote this open letter apologizing and saying how wonderful the Soviet Union is. It's a shame. I don't even know if he did it. And the attacks on him ceased, but he was arrested several times. And at the age of 59, he was pushed down the stairs. And in the Soviet Union, you know, don't just fall downstairs and die. That's generally not what happens. So chances are this was simply a way to get rid of him. The only difference between Kupala and Kolas is that Kolas was willing to cooperate with the Soviet Union. Kupala was not. Their contributions to the agrarian critique of modernity, which comes from, you know, taking from Chekhov's The Black Monk, which is such an essential way to conceive of all this stuff, made them both suspicious to the USSR. So I'm pretty sure that Kupala was killed. Kolas lived his life a bit of a, you know, great writer and an agrarian, but a bit of a hack. In that sense, in the sense that he, you know, was not willing to make war on the USSR. Anyway, I've gone over my time. Agrarianism is essential to both orthodoxy and nationalism, as I've just been talking about here. These two writers should be read far more than they are. Thank you, everyone, for listening. I'll talk to you next time. Bye-bye.
You've been listening to The Orthodox Nationalists with Dr. Matthew Raphael Johnson. and RadioArian.com.